Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
When I say Jackson Pollock, chances are the picture that forms in your mind is of one of his revolutionary action paintings, the exuberant masterpieces of color dripped and splashed across enormous canvases. These works are so iconic that even some of Pollock's fans are unaware that he turned late in his career to something very different. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. For a time in the early 1950s, Pollock set color largely aside, experimenting with thin black enamel paint on unprimed canvas that sometimes also featured figures. These new paintings vexed audiences who had made Pollock the most celebrated artist of his generation. The works were more challenging to embrace, harder to delight in, but as a new exhibition at the Dallas Museum of Art seeks to demonstrate, they were no less critical in Pollock's discovery of his own potential as an artist. Gavin Delahunty is Hoffman Family's Senior Curator of Contemporary Art at the Dallas Museum of Art. The exhibition Jackson Pollock Blind Spots is open at the DMA through March 20th. Gavin, welcome to Think.
Good morning.
This exhibition is called Blind Spots. What do we tend to overlook when we consider Jackson Pollock's career?
Well, just as you introduced, I find it fascinating that the all-over drip paintings, the classic period paintings by Pollock made between 47 and 1950, they were so magnetic, so powerful, so radical, so revolutionary that they forced the sort of blind spot in our ability to look outside of them. And that when I investigated that blind spot, I found not only this incredible body of black paintings, but works on paper, sculpture, prints that seem to have fallen between the cracks in the history of one of America's, if not the most famous artist America ever produced.
What's extraordinary to me is that he could have continued to be a very celebrated artist, even if he'd had a normal lifespan and had continued making the drip paintings. But mm-hmm. He was, if not done with them, he wanted to try something else.
Yeah, I think it's testament to Pollock as an extraordinary thinker, individual and artist, that unsatisfied with the acclaim and celebration, that he drove himself to think anew and think freshly about how he was making paintings and how he was transforming the history of painting as we had hitherto been known in relation to perspectivalism and how we see, how we view, how we physically stand and engage with a painting. And so the restlessness of him as a thinker, as an intellect and someone whom had an incredible Rolodex knowledge of painting, he sat down soberly and decided, I'm going to take a radical change of direction.
Soberly is a key word in considering Jackson Pollock's career. People know he famously struggled with alcoholism. One of the last sober paintings he did, right, is in the permanent collection of the DMA.
That's correct. You know, Portrait in a Dream is the... It was astounding to me that the stars aligned that I found myself not in an institution whereby I could bookend the exhibition with the magisterial 1947 Cathedral, which is a bona fide masterpiece in the classic drip period painting, and then conclude the show with one of the most controversial, inspiring and important works by Jackson Pollock, Portrait in a Dream, which was completed in 1953. And that work has been so talked about and unpacked by scholars because it's a single canvas composed of two elements. On the left is an abstract black pour painting, and on the right hand side is a self-portrait of Jackson Pollock that includes the colours red, yellow, blue. And that work is tantalizingly brilliant because it signals a gesture to us as the audience that this tackling Pollock had, or this revisiting of the conversation between figuration and abstraction that continued throughout his entire life from the 30s right through to the 50s, and that is there laid bare for us to see that perhaps he hadn't concluded that conversation with himself, he hadn't concluded that conversation with the canvas. And then sadly, after 1953, 54, he makes paintings, 55, there's barely a touch on a canvas, and 56, he is sadly taken away from us at a very early age.
What I like about Portrait in a Dream is that I feel like any time you look at a Jackson Pollock painting, you feel a little bit like you're climbing inside his brain. And this is almost like that exact idea right there.
Well, I think it's a brilliant analysis or viewpoint. And I think many of the individuals who've already visited the show, several of whom knew Pollock personally, many of whom have worked on Pollock as experts and scholars for some 30 years, they felt that about the exhibition, and they felt incredibly moved, and they were incredibly emotional whilst navigating the show, because they said for one of the first times in their experiences of encountering a Jackson Pollock show, that they felt inside the artist, that we had evoked the spirit of Jackson Pollock in the exhibition, and it's not an exaggeration to say that many of them were brought to tears navigating the show, because what was being laid bare was the last great gasp of one of the greatest artists of the 20th century, and he's wrestling with something that was bigger than him, quite frankly.
What was happening in his personal life between 1951 and 1953?
He had retreated to East Hampton and set about devising what would become the Black Paintings, and very much in consultation with Tony Smith and Barnett Newman, who were very close to him at that time. He had had a troubled relationship with the salacious presentation of his biography, and that forced this retreat into East Hampton, because being in the mix, the heady mix of New York, not the least because of the social scene, but because of the sibling rivalry he had with artists like de Kooning and Motherwell, he heads to East Hampton. He beds down. He experiments with works on paper, and gets very much involved with the materiality, the synthesis between the material he's using, whether it's ink or paint, and how it is absorbed and received by both various types of paint, but also the canvas. And so he feels he's discovered something that is going to be the breakthrough moment that's going to push forward his practice, and famously said, "I've discovered a way of making paintings that's going to make the kids who think it's easy to splash out a Jackson Pollock, you know, it's going to blow their minds." And that was one of the key quotes for me, where I thought, wow, you know, the artist truly believes that he has happened upon something. And he had, you know, if one was to follow the trajectory of Greenberg modernism, which ultimately was about paint should be paint and canvas should be canvas, and we need to be as honest to these two things as possible, and we shouldn't be replicating photography or replicating sculpture. We have to just let the paint be paint and let the canvas be canvas. And so if you were to naturally follow that progression, Pollock's discovery of synthesizing the black paint into the raw cotton material or substrate, the flattening of that, but also the paint is both on and in the canvas, that was so advanced for that time. And it was Helen Frankenthaler, it was Frank Stella, it was Rauschenberg, it was Ryman, all of those artists spotted it immediately. And it ultimately led to the next 20 years of color field abstraction.
I want to talk about the idea that the canvas was unprimed. I was reading a lot about what I was about to see before I saw the show itself, and it didn't fully connect with me until I saw it there.
Yes.
The effect is that with this unprimed canvas and this black enamel paint, sort of the first layer of it soaks in and is kind of matte.
Yes.
And then more paint that's applied has not a texture, but a different kind of, it reflects a little bit more, and it clearly is layered on top of the other paint.
Again, it's one of the main arguments about the exhibition, is this decision by Pollock to not prime. It wasn't always the case. He did sometimes retrospectively add a layer that adhered the canvas. But fundamentally, what he was interested in was these were not black and white paintings. These are black paintings. But the white that we perceived previously was because when they were reproduced in before desktop publishing and primitive publication methods, they appeared black and white as they were printed. But it is raw cotton duck. And he was absolutely fascinated and thrilled to see that he could merge the paint and the substrate, the paint and the canvas, the two primary elements of paint, of making a picture, And so he was joining them or fusing them in a way that hitherto had not been possible or seen by other artists. And so as you navigate the show, there are experiments where you see very explicitly the paint just completely being absorbed into the cotton material, and you get this kind of double line where it strikes the surface and then it has this kind of second halo-like layer on either side of the line, which has famously been described by Francis O'Connor in his 1980 show of the black paintings. But then he decides, okay, that's a layer and I'm very good at layering. I know this from making my classic drip paintings. And then he starts to add thinner layers using the upended dried paintbrushes, using a turkey baster, using his fingers in some instances. So he applies an extra layer of black and it glistens and sparkles on the surface, again in a way that he had not previously understood or perceived. And that was because he was using rather, well, completely inexpensive black enamel paint, industrial paint. And the way that that paint was acting on top of itself was again something new for Pollock, and he found that it gave it a sort of fluidity and dynamism and liquidity that only emphasized this idea of energy being made visible on the surface of the canvas.
This might sound like a funny question, but do we know anything about the people who sold Pollock this industrial paint? It must have been an odd experience to work at a store that normally deals with house painters and people who are like fixing a fence in somebody's backyard, to have this world-renowned, multi-million-dollar selling artist wander in and say, 10 gallons of that, 3 gallons of that.
Well, at the time, he whilst being incredibly successful and highly acclaimed critically, he still wasn't making huge amounts of money. And that, in fact, is played out in a very interesting way in the exhibition, whereby there is a room dedicated to a series of screen prints, 6, in fact, that he made in 1951. And he was so terrified before the exhibition opened in 1951 in Betty Parsons' gallery that he famously said to Betty Parsons, "All I want is $500. And if we make these portfolio of prints, we can sell them for $500 each." And they duly did do this. So that tells us something important, which is that he didn't have a fountain of cash available to him at that time. And we know that both de Kooning and Jackson Pollock used these industrial paints because, quite frankly, they were cheap. And they were incredibly prolific. And they were really on top of, they were confident and they wanted to experiment. They wanted to be free with the material in a way that if they had been using incredibly expensive or refined or rarefied paints, it would have inhibited them somehow from being as expressive and as experimental as their mind and body wanted them to be.
If I'm not mistaken, a couple of those screen prints looked identical to me, and I was wondering why they were both there.
It's a very good question. There is one set of the screen prints that is, it's one work reproduced 3 times. And it's a very beautiful, very important work that's come from a private collection in Switzerland. And what that work shows us is Jackson deciding, in fact, it's a screen print, an ink on paper work and a black enamel work. So it's the same image, but made in 3 different ways. And it's Pollock deciding, okay, I'm going to make this portfolio of prints, but am I going to do it by actually painting editions of the same work, or can I approach a printmaking by making a screen print, or shall I just do it in black ink? So what looks the same is actually 3 different process technical approaches, and in the end he alights upon screen printing for somewhat practical reasons. He knows that he can photographically reproduce and produce these serigraphs, as they were then known.
Gavin Delahunty is my guest. We're talking about Jackson Pollock Blind Spots, the exhibition at the Dallas Museum of Art through March 20th. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
painting is direct. I usually paint on the floor. I enjoy working on a large canvas. I feel more at home, more at ease in a big area. Having the canvas on the floor, I feel nearer, more of a part of the painting. This way I can walk around it, work from all four sides, and be in the painting, similar to the Indian sand painters of the West. Sometimes I use a brush, but often prefer using a stick. Sometimes I pour the paint straight out of the can. I like to use a dripping, fluid paint. A method of painting is the natural growth out of a need. I want to express my feelings rather than illustrate them. Technique is just a means of arriving at a statement.
That was the artist himself in the short film Jackson Pollock 51, released in 1951. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Gavin Delahunty, who is Hoffman Family's Senior Curator of Contemporary Art at the Dallas Museum of Art. The show Jackson Pollock Blind Spots is on exhibit through March 20th, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Gavin, I've seen that film before, and it's funny how sort of unemotional and almost pedantic he sounds in describing this technique. If you were trying to picture the kind of art created by someone like this and you only heard it on the radio, you might not imagine anything like the works that Pollock created.
It's so nice to hear that clip, and I'm glad that you played it because I've listened to it so many times and I had the same response, which is this very kind of stoic delivery. It's quite confident and quite almost self-reflective. It's almost, Pollock in that clip is not speaking out to the world. It's almost like he's speaking to himself. Mm. It's kind of rhetorical questioning. This is how I'm carrying out the production of these paintings. Is this okay? Almost every statement almost could end with a question mark. And I think I love the graininess of his voice. I love the there's a sort of heaviness on his chest as he's describing it, because he perhaps unsurprisingly, of course, there's a lot being said about his persona, his larger than life. When you met him, he had a kind of larger than life. But I think deep down, Pollock, like any artist who knows they have fundamentally changed the course of art history, that there was something terrifying about that. And I do feel in the rare few clips that we have of him speaking or preparing on film, there's a sort of palatable anxiety and tension about how he speaks, because he's setting out a path that no one had ever been down before.
How did he feel about the fact that he was a brand?
I can only speculate, but it would be a speculation based on many years of research. But he was not someone who liked being in that limelight and liked having that public persona. And it's a very socially, it's a very interesting moment. You know, the 1950s. You know, there's huge confidence in the United States. There's huge, the country is changing radically. You know, ideas, concepts around advertising, marketing, they are evolving at a rate of knots. And I think Pollock was kind of, in a sense, caught up in the maelstrom of those social and political and creative changes that were taking place. And so, you know, the Life magazine spread from 49 was unprecedented, you know, to have so many pages of that magazine given over to a singular artist and to pronounce or to announce to the world that this is the greatest living artist, full stop. And, you know, that must have been terrifying for Pollock, and I think that it made him nervous, and it made him sort of step back and observe this machine that was evolving around him. And I think it made him readdress his relationship with Greenberg. It made him readdress his relationship to his contemporaries. It made him readdress his relationship to his commercial gallery dealers. And I fundamentally believe that all of these components led to the black paintings, in a sense, because he he didn't want to be a sort of performer. Like, I use that word very particularly because, of course, there's a performative quality to the making of the paintings, but he didn't want to be, just be that performing, someone who splashes out a Jackson Pollock that, any child could do it or anyone can do it. Only Jackson Pollock could make those paintings. And I think all of that was like the paint hitting the raw canvas and seeping into that canvas. All of that information was seeping into his brain and it was making him more and more. His eyes were getting narrower and narrower and he was thinking, I'm going to do something so radical that no one is going to know what's going to happen.
I gather he did bristle at the jokes that were told about, the fact that anybody could do this, that you could, give, a chimpanzee enough paint. And can you talk about what it took for Pollock, not simply his brilliance, not only in conceiving of doing art in this new way, but in executing the paintings that he did?
It's a fascinating story, and I think with the benefit of technology now, and we have the capacity to take X-rays of these paintings. Many of them have had that process. We can see that there are incredibly complex, formal, compositional structures beneath the all-over drip paintings, and how they were built up in layers. The Pollock's, what I've described as, it's like an eye, brain, wrist nexus that involves the manipulation, I would not say control, but it's the manipulation of gravity, is astounding. And they reveal to us someone who is, when he was in the zone, or as the clip expressed, that he's in the painting, when he's in the moment in the painting, and when those elements of the eye, brain and wrist under the control of Pollock are in synchronicity, there is a magical, something magical happens on the canvas. And in the drip paintings, he's then building up those layers using various colours that have this labyrinthine effect, that your eye is restless and you no longer have a subject or a perspective to which your eye gazes into the canvas. He forces you to interact and to play with the canvas, and you're moving backwards and forwards and your eye is transversing the whole canvas. That was exceptional. In the black paintings, however, there's nowhere to hide. And I've described this, and so he's building up the layers in the all-over drip paintings, and so should Pollock have made a mistake, if he ever made a mistake, he could, using the next layer, somehow disguise it. But what one of the revelationary aspects of the black paintings is that he reduces the radical reduction of both colour to exclusive black and the radical reduction of the layers to one. There's nowhere for him to go. It's him at his most masterful, most confident and most in control of those elements, eye, brain, wrist and gravity, and showing off his technique in an expression of, this is not easy. This is far from easy.
He did paint figures in his earlier work. They were sort of hidden in a lot of more abstract color, but they were there. And then he stopped, and then people were a little taken aback to see that he went back to them.
There is a really important early and unique overpainted photograph that actually opens the exhibition. Very modest work in scale, very important and very powerful in its echo throughout Pollock's entire career. It's from 1944, and it's a mother and child, child on mother's lap, looking lovingly into his mother's eyes, that Pollock has taken black ink and grotesqued or transformed that relationship between both the mother and child, but also our capacity to see what's on the photograph. And the show opens with that because I wanted to make the point that figuration had played a very important role in Pollock's work, from the 30, from the very beginning of his career right through to the end. And again, that was disappointing to many to see the return of Figuration, because in 1947 and 1950, some of the great champions of Jackson Pollock's work were definitively saying, finally, we've managed to crowbar ourselves away from this figure-ground relationship that has dominated the discussion around painting for millennia. And Jackson Pollock is the man who has done that for us. We no longer are at the in service of having some figurative element that is going to invite interest by the viewer, that he's created a new way of painting that is both it's about opticality and about a cerebral response to the canvas. Now, when the figure returns, many saw that as a retrogressive step, like a backward step to a moment that they felt Pollock had emancipated us from. But with the benefit of having 60 years of seeing the development of painting and neo-expressionism and post-painterly abstraction, and how the figure, the conversation between figuration and abstraction, has continued to dominate painting in the time since the Black paintings. And I think for Pollock, quite frankly, that conversation wasn't over, and that's why it reemerges in the Black paintings.
I'm not an expert in art, I know the things that are recognized to be the great masterworks of sort of Western art. And, you know, having been born in 1970, there's a lot to excite me in Jackson Pollock's work, but there's nothing that shocks me, right? Because it's always been part of the landscape. And sometimes I wonder what it would look like, what it would feel like to experience somebody who changed things today as much as Pollock did in his own era.
That we have tried to do, in a sense, in the exhibition, because one of the things you will notice when you visit the museum and visit the show is that we have sort of created a time machine whereby you can go back in time to experience the Black paintings as they were originally hung by Jackson Pollock. It's one of the few times in the museum's history where we completely demolished the special exhibition space and rebuilt the entire space up. Every wall, every skirting board, the carpet, the distance from the paintings from on the wall to the floor, everything was researched, and even to the spaces in which they exist are based upon the scale of Betty Parsons' gallery and Sidney Janis' gallery, where the second show of Black paintings took place in 52. It's a brilliant question, because I wanted to recreate for our visitors the experience of seeing them for the first time, so you really get the sense of the radicalness of those paintings. And that was a challenge, because as someone who was educated in the 90s and 2000s, and for whom, you know, the art, the American art of the 1960s, the white cube, minimal installation is predominantly my modus operandi, to resist the temptation to elevate singular works by Pollock in the way that you see in every major museum in the world, for good reason. You encounter a Jackson Pollock on a wall on its own.
It's not in the corner somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Like at a particular distance, so it's kind of elevated to this, you know, to the level of master. And for this particular show and for this particular installation, we went back to incredibly rare archival photographs, interestingly enough, taken by Robert Rauschenberg of the 51 show. We measured the distance between each of the paintings, the distance from the paintings to the floor, you know, the scale of the galleries, and we installed them in the way that Pollock originally wanted you to see them, which was you walk into the space and it's an overwhelming experience. Your eye does not know where to go, your body does not know where to go, and you have to suddenly feverishly navigate the space and trying to alight on which painting should I look at first. And Pollock loved this almost installation quality of his hangs. And so I hope that to your question of what would it be like today to experience something as radical, I think what we've tried to do, at least in the exhibition, is to give back some of that sense of awe and astonishment, not only of the radical change of direction, but in the sense of how these paintings were installed.
Nobody wanted to buy them when they were first exhibited.
No. I think the world the art world that encompasses, you know, the commercial side, the critical side, they had just about got their minds around the all-over drip paintings and how they were made and the processes by which they were made and what they were doing to paint and what they were doing to art making. And so when the black paintings were revealed, and Pollock preempted, you know, he was nervous about it, he knew. When they were revealed, I think they shocked the audience because they wanted more of the same. And famously, Charles Egan, a prominent gallerist at that time, marched up to Jackson at the opening and said, "Great show, Jackson, but can you please do it in colour next time?" And Pollock was devastated. You know, he had spent a year producing this body of work, had told his close friends, Alfonso Osorio, Tony Smith, of course, his wife, Lee Krasner, that he was really onto something. And then for it to be smacked down in that way, he took it very poorly. And two of the paintings ultimately were sold out of that exhibition. But shockingly, perhaps for your listeners, one of those paintings was sold at a discounted price of 50% for $1,500.
I bet there are a lot of people who love Jackson Pollock. I would have liked to be there at that show. And
I am one of them.
Get the bargain of the century. All right, we'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. We're speaking this hour with Gavin Delahunty, who curated Jackson Pollock Blind Spots, the exhibition at the Dallas Museum of Art that will be available through March 20th. He is Hoffman Family Senior Curator of Contemporary Art at the DMA. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or call 1-800-933-5377.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test-prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The Dallas Museum of Art has a show on exhibit now called Jackson Pollock Blind Spots. We're speaking this hour with Gavin Delahunty, who is Hoffman Family Senior Curator of Contemporary Art at the DMA. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. One painting in the show, I think done in 1949, so a little bit before this, number 12, was wonderfully described on the placard as a big brassy gigolo of a painting. And I guess that was a description from the time. And I love that, because getting ready for this interview, I was thinking about the challenges of talking about visual art in general, but about Pollock's work in particular. How do you find the language to describe the almost indescribable qualities in Pollock's work?
Well, if I may, it was actually made in 1952, that painting.
Oh, okay.
And when it was first shown in 1952, together with Convergence, also shown in 1952, and is in this recreation of the Sidney Janis show from that moment. Those are the two paintings, Convergence and Number 12, that you noted, that everyone loved. And it, sadly, is because colour had begun to appear again in Pollock's painting, and particularly red, yellow, blue. And Number 12 was that exhibition was voted in the top 10 exhibitions of the year in 1952. And so it was a move again by Pollock to do something different. But in relation to language, certainly from my training and perspective, I think one way to approach Pollock is with your own eyes. And I think Pollock's great, one of Pollock's great abilities was to remind us of the power of the eye and remind us of it as a tool and as a machine, and that he wanted your eye to have a frenzied response to his paintings. And so what I mean by that is, so but prior to Pollock, or let's just say figurative painting in general, that what you're seeing is something that is somewhat familiar, and then you process that information and you build a picture, you kind of cobble together those components and you assemble it in your brain, and it makes you feel good. You know, it makes you, that is a beautiful rendering of a mountain and a sunset, and oh, how charming. Of course, that's a very simplistic kind of summary. But Pollock was pushing us to use our brains and our bodies in a way that had not been done by painting before. And so you encounter a Jackson Pollock and you kind of take a step back because you say to yourself, what is this, incredible, labyrinthine, layered, splattered, splashed, dripped, poured object that stands in front of me? And it draws you in. You start to see various lines, various tributaries, various uses of color, various uses of applications of paint, and it's like Alice in Wonderland sense. It's like going down the rabbit hole where you get lost in the paintings. And it's been fascinating to me. The show opens with a room of the classic drip paintings in Cathedral from 1947, which is one of the greatest from that period. We've used these very low Mies van der Rohe day beds, black leather seating that was quite popular in the 1950s. And every day I go into the galleries, there is someone on the daybed staring at Cathedral, almost in a hypnotic trance. Mm. And it's from 10-year-olds to 40-year-olds to 80-year-olds, people of various generations, and they're transfixed by this painting. And it fills me with joy because he pulled it off. You know, he pulled off this transformation of how we engage with the world and how we engage with painting and how we engage with ourselves. And it forces you to not only you're physically looking at the picture, but you're lost, and it breeds thoughts in your mind and thoughts in yourself that Pollock somehow he forces you not only to simultaneously look at the picture, but to think about yourself. And great art makes you reflect upon yourself, and Pollock's paintings manage to do that.
Did he feel that return to color? It's not like he, you know, wrote in blood, "I will never use anything but black again," but was it a capitulation for him?
The return to color, I think, was probably always on the cards. And there had been as I mentioned previously, you know, Pollock was incredibly competitive, and he knew that de Kooning and Motherwell and Klein, amongst others, were making pictures using black and white. And Pollock took that, of course, a step further by just exclusively using black. But I think he wanted to show his friends and show his peers that he too could make these incredible paintings. And they do reference Picasso and Guernica, and they do reference even artists like Goya, and who had black periods. And so it's Pollock both demonstrating he's not some class clown that splashes out paintings, but is someone who has an understanding of art history, has an understanding of contemporary art, vis-a-vis de Kooning, Klein and Motherwell, but also with someone who's going to take that a step further. And so he delivers the astonishing show in Betty Parsons in 1951. It is critical and commercially less successful than he had hoped. But there is one very interesting painting in the show that is on loan from a private collection in Japan, and it is a black painting. It's in fact an all-over drip painting that he has submerged in black back to the overpainted photograph, but he has introduced those primary elements of red, yellow, blue into the picture. And it's made in 1950. 51 is the all-over black period. And 52, you see those colours returning. So, again, I almost feel that Pollock is... He's not... what's that turn of... He's not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. He's... Okay, this is like a little note to self. In 1950, he goes headfirst into all exclusive black paintings in 51, and then receiving the information, receiving the comments about the 51 show, he does reintroduce colour. And I think Convergence, which is the largest canvas in the exhibition and is in the second to last room, painted in 52, is an extraordinary picture, and it's been described as the meat and the bones of Jackson Pollock, and the meat being the colour and the bones being this black superstructure onto which the colour floats. And he combines the black pouring method with the skeleton of the painting, and then onto which he's using red, yellow, blue and white in a different viscosity, in a different paint quality. And that has this effect of the colour floating like clouds on top of this black structure. And it's so beautiful and so mesmerising. It's like having a bird's eye view above the clouds of a world that we can never quite grasp.
If it's not already obvious to people, it has been definitively demonstrated that none of Pollock's works like came together in an afternoon. Can you talk about that?
You know, one of the, as a curator and art historian, many people have asked me, you know, what would you like, what would you say to Jackson Pollock? What would you say to Matisse? What would you say to Picasso? And I always say, I wouldn't like to say anything to them, but what I would like to ask them is, could I watch them paint? And I will more than likely never have that opportunity with any of those artists. But I still have had many discussions, many debates with some of the greatest Pollock scholars in the world about that exact question. You know, how long did it take him? How, you know, over how many sessions were they made? How were they edited? How did he prepare how much of the canvas did he actually lay out on the floor before he executed them? And even specifically with the current exhibition of the black paintings, they were often made on these huge rolls of canvas that he edited afterwards. He cut and edited them afterwards. And I use the word editing very specifically because Pollock was very interested in cinema. And his wife, Lee Krasner, is famed for saying, you know, I was there when Pollock edited the pictures, but I never edited them myself. And I find that fascinating that he would give over himself fully to the creation of these paintings, and then would, and there's a famous image by Hans Nemuth of this enormous canvas with perhaps up to 7 of the black paintings on one singular canvas that then he goes back in and cuts and edits. And that, to me, that violation, I find absolutely both personally terrifying, but for Pollock, I just find, you know, what an incredibly confident individual, what someone with such vision that he would create multiple paintings on a single canvas and then go back in with his scissors and cut them into the way that he wanted.
Did he ever discard things he was unhappy with?
I would have to say yes, but I do not know that for sure. You know, all artists have a personal and very subjective way of assessing whether something is success, quote unquote, or failure. And Pollock was so prolific and was so the output at that time. You know, it was literally hit the energy and the ideas were he was overflowing at that moment in 1951. And so one can only assume that there were successes and failures. Yes.
He died in 1956. He didn't commit suicide, but he died in an accident that he caused driving while he was drunk. Do you think if he had lived another few decades that we would look at this period in his career in a different way?
Yes. I think It's one of the great sadnesses for me that Pollock was, or that died, was killed and taken away, taken out of the conversation of the history of 20th century painting so early. And the final room of the exhibition, whilst I desperately did not want it to be melancholy, there is a sort of melancholy there, because the final room, which was ostensibly built around the display of Portrait in a Dream, which also includes a very important painting called Yellow Islands from the Tate Museum in London, and a very rare sculpture which has never been seen in a public institution before. Just three elements. Kind of surprising to see the sculpture, although sculpture was something he was interested in all his life. And then two...
It's very tiny.
It's very tiny. Yeah, they're like little jewels, those sculptures. And we can talk about them in great detail if you wish. But the final, that final room, so Portrait in a Dream, 53, Yellow Islands, 52. We know he dies in 56. The struggle of the black paintings, both internally and externally in the public realm, has been laid bare to you throughout the entire exhibition. And you see him almost residing in himself. Perhaps the figuration and abstraction should be kept separate from one another. And I'm going to need to reassess what I've done in 51 and 52 and to take my practice to the next level. That it's sort of frustratingly... It's like an appetizer almost, even though it's the end. It sounds perverse, but it's the end of his career, but it's almost like it's the beginning. So the beginning, the end is the beginning, but we never get to see the rest of the story because he tragically dies so young. And I can only imagine what incredible progression Pollock would have continued to do should he have lived longer. And it is... part of the sadness of the story of the show that we will never get to see those pictures.
Is there anything you would have liked to include in this exhibition that you couldn't get your hands on?
There are always highlights and lowlights. And when you work on an exhibition for 4 years, as this project has taken to see to fruition. And my simple plan 4 years ago was to assemble the largest number of the black paintings ever seen. And we know that there were 11 of those pictures in 1980. They were 17 of the black paintings exhibited by William Lieberman in 1967, and 9 in MoMA's show in 1998, the Museum of Modern Art. And we have 31 of those paintings in Dallas. And whilst I know there are some more out there in the world, and I know personally their owners, all of whom are very nice, that was enough for me, and I felt very excited to be able to show them.
Gavin Delahunty is Hoffman Family Senior Curator of Contemporary Art at the Dallas Museum of Art. The exhibition Jackson Pollock Blind Spots is open at the DMA through March 20th. Gavin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.